It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Milwaukee Common Council is seeking tougher penalties for people who solicit sex there as part of a broad effort to reduce human trafficking. We'll learn more coming up. First, let's say you're cooking something in a skillet and you gotta flip it, not with a spatula, but with a flick of your wrist. They make it look so easy on TV, don't they? But in your mind's eye, you see half the food landing all over the stove. Do you dare to try it? Or do you come up with some other kind of safer way, but more tedious method to do it? If you ask Julia Child, she'd say, just go for it.
When you flip anything, you just have to have the courage of your convictions, particularly if it's sort of a loose mass like this. Well, that didn't go very well. See, when I flipped it, I didn't have the courage to do it the way I should have. But you can always pick it up, and if you're alone in the kitchen, who is going to see? But the only way you learn how to flip things is just to flip them.
In this week's Food Friday, we're going to talk about our culinary failures, how to salvage our messes, and how to learn from our mistakes in the kitchen. Sonia and Alex Overheiser are the husband and wife team behind the book A Couple Cooks, Pretty Simple Cooking, 100 Delicious Vegetarian Recipes to Make You Fall in Love with Real Food. They also host the Small Bites podcast. Sonia and Alex, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
We're glad to be here.
Well, have either of you had that food flipping failure in your lives?
Oh, absolutely. All the time.
If you see the top of our stove, it definitely tells a story. Some failures there.
Yeah, I mean, even when I try to flip an omelet with the spatula, sometimes it ends up, 90% in the pan and 10% on the stovetop. But that's the key, though. As Julia Child said, Sonia, learning from our mistakes. How important is that for us as cooks?
Oh, absolutely. Cooking is all about learning from failure. And when Alex and I first started cooking together, we actually started watching some of Julia's shows, including the clip that you played. And we were so encouraged by her spirit of just saying, if you don't get it one time, you'll get it the next time and just try again. And so failure has always been a part of the process for us, especially as recipe developers, as our career now. We learned so much from failure. Some of our best recipes have come out of some really bad failures that then we have turned into some of our greatest successes.
And Alex, is that reassuring as a cook to see even Julia Child on camera kind of botch that flip?
Yeah, I love it because I think in today's internet culture, you kind of see the best of things often. But that was pretty much one take. It didn't work well and she just rolled with it. And you really learn a lot from that.
Sonia, is there a way that we can fail smart? I'll talk about these probably. I've definitely started projects that are way out of my league and probably so far out that I didn't learn anything. Is there a way to come into things that it pushes the envelope a little? There's some risk, but it just advances our knowledge that much?
Yeah, I think that's a good point of starting kind of somewhere right in the middle where it's not too dumbed down for you, but it's just pushing your boundaries enough so that you can learn that little nugget of what the recipe can teach you.
And Alex, that's how I understand your cookbook is laid out. You start with the easier stuff and then move on to the more advanced material, right?
That's right. In our cookbook, we decided that in each chapter, we would make the easiest and the fastest recipes at the beginning. So as you're scrolling through, they seem very, very accessible. And then as you get towards the end of a chapter, you might find something more complicated. So, for example, a quick pasta at the front and then a nice, delicious lasagna at the end.
We're talking to Sonia and Alex Overheiser, authors of the book A Couple Cooks, Pretty Simple Cooking. We are talking about failing in the kitchen and learning from our mistakes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Share the story of one of your kitchen fiascos. Call in at 800-642-1234. And don't worry, we're going to share some of ours, too. Sonia, do you want to start us off? Do you want to point toward a kitchen experiment gone wrong?
So now's when we share all our dirty laundry, huh?
Yeah.
So one failure that I remember particularly, some of the ones that hurt the most are when we have people over for dinner. We're trying to show off our cooking and then we have a big fail. So one that I remember is I was making some homemade croutons and I decided, hey, I'm going to speed these up. I'll just throw them in the broiler. So I put some bread in the broiler and then went about my cooking. Our guests came. We were drinking some wine. We started smelling something a little bit off. And I said, oh, no, the croutons. We opened the broiler and they were engulfed in flames. Alex took them out in this really dramatic gesture, and I was just kind of laughing nervously to our guests. And this is, you know, when we were cookbook authors, so they had an expectation that they were going to have this great meal, and they got some flaming croutons.
And Alex, do you have one to share?
Well, I'm thinking again of having guests over, and again, you know, having guests, you get distracted. So we had some chicken, a whole chicken on the grill with a brick on top of it. And
it's called chicken under a brick. It's
a method of
cooking.
We're not crazy. But it was crazy to leave the grill because after about 10 minutes, I went out to check on it. And again, it was on fire and everything was blackened, totally inedible, and we had no backup plan. So that was a fail.
Well, I'll share two of mine real quick. In my 20s, I went for an experimental method of cooking where I decided I'd try to make something, no recipe, not talking to anybody. The big one was I tried to make pierogies, the Polish dumplings that my grandma used to make, famously labor-intensive. You have to boil the stuff filled with a floury thing. And I just guessed on everything. And so the end result was this boiling pot of water with clumps of flour here and veggies here. And it was completely inedible. And then the first time I tried to cook something with bay leaves, I made spaghetti, diced up the bay leaves, thought, well, these are sharp and pokey, but I guess they soften up when you cook with them. I very carefully ate that spaghetti sauce to not lacerate myself from the inside out. So those are mine. But your stories make me think one idea is, and this, I kind of do this, like if it's, okay, I got home from work, I got to get the kids fed in an hour, I'm not going to take a chance then. If I've got hours on the weekend, that's when I'm going to try something maybe new. Sonia, is that something you guys try?
Definitely. When we're trying to get meals on the table quickly, there's much less time for experimentation and taking risks. So we play it safe when we're just trying to eat a quick meal. And then we leave some of our experimentation times for the weekend for sure.
And Alex, I think accumulating some wins for the new cook can be a great thing to build confidence. What kind of things can people try to cook? We've got a few of your easy recipes that you've shared, by the way, at WPR.org/FoodFriday. What kind of things do you recommend people, the new cooks, start off with to make something good?
Man, that's a tough one. I think just any recipe that has some sort of fresh ingredient in there. So go to your farmer's market, talk to a farmer and find out what is fresh that week, and then find a recipe using that ingredient. And if it's a simple one, that's even better. But when you base a recipe around a single ingredient, you get so much flavor coming out.
Well, we've got
The recipes that we shared that is on the website is our smashed white bean sandwiches. And it's a take on a tuna salad using white beans. So you just kind of mash up the beans, add in a little bit of mayo, some celery, some green onions, and it makes this super flavorful, tangy salad that you can put on toast. You can eat it on a bagel, any really quick meal. It's a great component for your fast and everyday cooking.
And I love this because it looks like it comes together pretty easy. I looked at the recipe, but I think if somebody made this, people would be like, wow, a bean sandwich? I had no idea. You'd really impress somebody with this one.
Definitely. We have so many people who try this and are converts to the white bean salad.
We've got some callers lined up who have some failures to share. Let's go to James now in Madison. James, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. When I was a freshman in college, I invited a friend over for Thanksgiving who was from out of town, and I was telling my mom, who was a home economics teacher, and how her cooking was so great, but we had forgot to put the seasoning in the stuffing from the box stuffing, and it tasted just like cardboard. It was disgusting.
All right. That was a learning moment. Check all the ingredients, James. Thanks for sharing that. What is there kind of like a double check process, Alex, that people can use to make sure they don't overlook that one simple thing? I can think of times when I skipped that one vital step that kind of killed a recipe.
I mean, the number one thing is to read the entire recipe before you start cooking, and I'm really bad at that. But you have to read through, because then you might be halfway through a recipe and realize that something was supposed to soak for 2 hours,
yes,
and you already have half the stuff done.
Or I've hit the recipe in the middle. Like, I looked at the cooking time, the baking time at the end, but I missed in the middle where it says bake whatever for an hour as a step, and the dinner's an hour late. Thanks for that.
Been there, too.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Phil in Mount Horeb now. Phil, hi.
Hi.
I was intrigued by the opening story on flipping something in a skillet. You know, I'm probably the least coordinated of all the people who will call in or you'll talk to in the next 3 years, but I learned a foolproof way of doing this, and it is this. Let's talk about a single egg in a small skillet, a small nonstick skillet, and you don't do this over the stove. You do it over the sink, which you've meticulously washed, so that you can, if you hate wasting food like I do, you can take the half-cooked egg and put it back in the pan. So you break the egg into the pan, which has been sprayed with you know, a nonstick oil kind of spray, and then you you break the yolk, and you let this cook to in the bottom, so it's sort of firm on the bottom, not real firm, but then you take it over the sink, and you hold it horizontal to the sink, that is right over the sink level, and you thrust the pan forward like 4 inches, and you tip the back of the pan, that is the one away from you, up in about 4 inches, and then jerk it up, and the egg will just flip right over as you pull the pan back underneath the egg. Huh. Now, this may sound like a lot of coordination, but it's not. If I can do it, anybody can do it. I do it successfully at least 90% of the time. And then you just cook the other side of the egg, the one that's now down.
Phil, I'm going to jump in because we're going to have to pause for a moment. Thank you so much for sharing that technique. We are talking about cooking failures and how we can learn from our mistakes. Sonia and Alex Overheiser are with us, authors of A Couple Cooks, Pretty Simple Cooking, 100 Delicious Vegetarian Recipes to Make You Fall in Love with Real Food. You can find their work at their blog as well. We are taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Share your favorite or least favorite cooking failure with us. 800-642-1234. More of your calls coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about failure in the kitchen and what we can learn from it. Sonia and Alex Overheiser are with us. They host the Small Bites podcast. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What was your biggest cooking failure? What lessons did you learn from it? And how did you learn to have courage in the kitchen? Call 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, I want to check out another recipe you shared with us. We have it at WPR.org/Food Friday. Sonia, tell us about this California toast with roasted almond butter and berries.
Sure. Well, it sounds very fancy, but it's actually just a cheater's way to make French toast. So what we've done is just take a homemade almond butter. So if you have a food processor, you can whip up a homemade almond butter. It doesn't take too long. It's pretty simple to make. And then you spread that onto toast and eat it as you would a French toast. You eat it with a fork and a knife, top it with some fruit and some maple syrup, and it tastes like French toast, but even a little bit better.
That sounds really good. And Alex, I mentioned the phrase, I think, courage. How important is it for us to have that courage and take chances in the kitchen, even knowing there's that risk of failure?
Oh, I think it's the best part of cooking, personally. I love the experimentation. I love to get in there and see what you can create. Sure, you have a recipe to start from, but there's nothing quite like a recipe that you made your own. And I'd rather eat a few kind of okay recipes that failed a little bit and have one blockbuster than always kind of play it safe.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jamie is with us in Mineral Point. Jamie, hi.
Hi. Well, this is certainly memorable because it was, I think, almost 70 years ago that it happened. But I was invited to a ham dinner cooked by Ann Krantz and my wife-to-be, Jackie, and wasn't discovered until it was time to carve the ham that they had neglected to take the transparent plastic wrapper off. And at first, it was extremely hard to get the knife to cut into it, but when we did, we found out that what was underneath it was really tasting more like burned plastic than like ham.
Oh, Jamie, thank you. That stuck with him for 70 years. Wow. Yeah, How do we avoid doing something like that? I guess if we just don't know what we're doing with a new ingredient, Sonia, how do we make sure we don't make that critical error?
I don't know if you can ever fully feel safe yourself, but I do know that those lessons learned the hard way are the ones that stick. I'm assuming that you will never mince up your bay leaf ever again.
Very, very true. Very true. Thank you so much, Jamie. I bet that taste is still, you still remember that taste. We'll go now to Michael with us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about Michael?
A number of years ago, a friend of mine from college in Minnesota came to visit me here in Wisconsin from Connecticut. And we had always enjoyed cooking together when we were at school and decided to do some cooking while he was visiting. We actually decided to make wings using a recipe from one of the America's Test Kitchen cookbooks. And the recipe called for some amount of a, quote, pepper sauce of your choosing. And during our shopping trip, we decided, because we both enjoy spicy food, to pick out some variety of a habanero sauce. Uh-oh. And followed the recipe and used the amount prescribed. And upon our initial tasting, discovered that our hot sauce caused copious amounts of tears.
Oh, no.
Thankfully, before serving, we were able to doctor it to a palatable version using copious amounts of blue cheese dressing.
All right. Well, you were able to fix it. All right, Michael, thank you so much for sharing that. And you know, let's talk about, Alex, you know, sometimes you melted plastic in your ham. There's no saving that. But when there's a salvageable mistake, how can we get started on trying to fix that recipe that's wrong, but maybe not too wrong?
I think a lot of times that's exactly the case. You just have something that's kind of bland, but not very exciting. And so we like to have those cheeses and hot sauces available that you can kind of doctor up something that's a little bit pale and make it delicious.
Thank you so much for sharing that story. I'm glad you recovered from the habanero sauce. And one of my tips, if I'm making something like a soup or something that needs that something, a lot of times it's just like an acid, a red wine vinegar or lemon or something. Like that one last bit of flavor is what makes the difference between boring and pretty tasty. Sonia, do you have any go-to ingredients like Alex was just mentioning to rescue us from blandness?
I was going to say the same thing as you. Oh. A little bit of lemon is perfect to help the end flavor. Also, just salt. A lot of people don't know how to use salt correctly. We certainly didn't when we started cooking. And being able to salt something to taste is a really important skill for every cook. Sometimes something tastes totally bland and all you need to do is a little kosher salt and it makes the flavor just pop.
Let's go back to our callers. We're talking about food failures. Sonia and Alex Overheiser are with us, authors of the book, A Couple Cooks, Pretty Simple Cooking. Back to our callers. David is with us in Oregon. David, hi.
Hi, good afternoon.
What's your story, David?
So this isn't a recipe failure. This is basically a cooking failure. So a number of years back, went to my sister's house for Thanksgiving. And there's a number of people there, probably 15 people. Turkeys were done the night before. We all gathered late morning, and we're talking. And my sister started the oven up to warm up for pies, okay? And all of a sudden, everybody's walking around going, this doesn't smell right. Must be the furnace. And then finally, we figured out it was coming from the oven, opened up the oven. And what happened was the day before, my brother-in-law had a tube of butyl caulk he was warming up to caulk gutters, and it was left in there. Butyl caulk is basically tar in a tube, by the way.
Okay?
So the oven opens up, and guess what? Air comes in. We have a big flare-up. And now this isn't like a nice oak fire. This is a black that fills the kitchen and the house. And so this came down into family lore. Everybody laughs about it. And, you know, so dinner's done. Let's go out. You know, kind of like the Christmas story. Let's go out to dinner. And it's become a very funny family lore.
David, thank you so much. Sonia, talk about that. Sometimes the ones we remember are the entertaining failures.
Absolutely. And his story actually reminded me of a failure that has happened to us multiple times. Alex is very into baking sourdough bread. And when he proofs his bread, he proofs it in the oven in a plastic bag. And sometimes he fails to tell his wife that he's proofing in the oven. She goes on.
Or she ignores the sign on the oven.
Or that. So I go to preheat the oven to make some granola. And then I start smelling something a little funky. It's plastic melted into our bread dough.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to pick on the two of you, but sometimes cooking together, that, you know, passing the baton between one task and another, that adds an element of risk, doesn't it, Alex?
It sure does. We've learned that it's kind of better to have one person in charge and the other person can kind of clean up behind or maybe do some prep work, but otherwise you end up blaming each other for those failures.
That's how we do it in my house. Like, one of us will be the lead cook, and if somebody else is doing stuff, we'll have one of us be the prep cook, and that seems to work out pretty well. But yeah, you need the lead contractor, I guess. Well, Sonia, we've got just a couple minutes left. I'm hoping both of you can give us a little inspiration, despite all the disasters we've heard about, to try to expand our repertoire in the kitchen.
Sure. That's exactly why we wrote our book, Pretty Simple Cooking, was just to provide ways for people who might not be experienced in the kitchen to start taking some of those risks and make some really delicious food. So as we said, our book goes from very, very simple to a little bit more complex as the book goes along. And so it's the perfect place to try something new. For example, if you've never made homemade whipped cream before, it's a great place to start. That's the last one of the recipes that we've shared with you over on the website. Is a homemade whipped cream whipped just by hand with a whisk, and it's perfect with summer fruits. So summer is coming up. This will be perfect with some strawberries that will soon be in season and berries throughout the year. So it's a really fun way to be able to do a kitchen skill that you might not have done before.
And briefly, Alex, just a few moments left. Since you two are open about your cooking fails, are people pretty willing to confess them to you as well?
Yeah, we see them on Instagram, and usually they don't blame us, but people love to share when they make our recipes, both good and bad.
Well, Sonia and Alex, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for having us.
Been talking to Sonia and Alex Overheiser. They're the husband and wife team behind the book, A Couple Cooks, Pretty Simple Cooking, 100 Delicious Vegetarian Recipes to Make You Fall in Love with Real Food, not Fail in Love with Real Food. They also host the Small Bites podcast. We talked to them about cooking failures and how we can learn from our mistakes. We posted three of their easier recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. Check them out and send us pictures, no matter how they come out. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. People who solicit sex in Milwaukee could face harsher penalties if a proposal is approved by the city's Common Council. The move is part of a broad effort to tackle human trafficking in Milwaukee. City leaders hope that penalizing Johns, as they're often called, will help address the issue. Our next guest joins us to give us an overview and tell us what else might be in the works. Mary Spacuzza covers politics and breaking news for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Mary, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, can you tell us more about this plan that's being floated in the Milwaukee Common Council?
Sure. So they are planning to increase penalties or fines for Johns, people who are caught trying to solicit prostitutes. And the idea is to try to cut down on demand for prostitution by going after the people, often men, who are trying to hire them. So the penalty would be a dramatic increase. It's currently starts at $500 and goes up to $5,000. And under this plan, it would start at $5,000 and go up to $10,000. So 10 times the increase for the first time.
And who is leading the charge to make this change here?
It's Alderman Russell Stamper, who has been speaking out a lot about prostitution problems in his district, but it really had very broad support at the committee where it advanced today. It's been a problem on the north side, the south side, and there's been a lot of awareness about how not all prostitutes are there willingly, and there's been a lot of discussion about sex trafficking of children, how some of these prostitutes are underage and are not even old enough to consent to sex in the first place, or they're there by, you know, force or fraud or coercion is typically how the pimps, when they're charged, are those are kind of the crimes that they're facing, where they're basically, you know, either threatening a girl or hurting her and really kind of controlling their lives. So it's part of an effort to, rather than just rearresting the women, to really try to target the men who are hiring prostitutes.
Right. This is a change in approach because, and I think you quoted some people talking about what you just said, the idea that the previous efforts had focused on prostitutes or the girls or women being trafficked hasn't really worked and maybe isn't fair. What kind of things were people saying about that?
Yeah, they were talking about how, you know, just simply rearresting prostitutes over and over again, especially if they're not the ones keeping the money and all the money is going to a pimp or a sex trafficker, just simply rearresting the girls or women is probably not going to be super effective in combating this. Not all prostitutes are trafficked. Some are, you know, there and keep their money, but we have seen huge problems with sex trafficking and child sex trafficking in Milwaukee. And there have been some recent convictions of pimps or recent charges against pimps who really seem to control these young women and girls.
Yeah, what kind of other efforts are going in Milwaukee in addition to this proposal to boost, significantly boost penalties for those who solicit prostitution?
A couple of the Southside aldermen, Alderman Bob Donovan and Alderman Jose Perez, over a year ago now, they unveiled a proposal to kind of publicly shame people who are Johns or who are caught soliciting prostitutes, sending letters home to their house where, especially if they have a wife or someone there, will not be happy to hear about that they were soliciting prostitutes. They've talked about billboards, but there's also been a growing push to provide services to prostitutes and especially trafficking victims to try to provide housing and services, counseling, resources to kind of get them away from, especially if they're being trafficked by a pimp, to get them out of that lifestyle and try to teach them that there's another world out there.
Talking to Mary Spacuzza, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about a boost, a substantial boost in fines for people charged with soliciting prostitution in Milwaukee. Mary, you've also written about a related story, a strip club facing a federal investigation into trafficking. What's going on?
Right. So there were some court documents that were recently filed that were search warrants. And in those search warrants, there was, you know, FBI agent basically writing about why they were doing these search warrants. And a familiar name who's owned a number of strip clubs came up in that, Radomir Buzdum. And many of us in Milwaukee know him as the co-owner of Silk Exotic Strip Club in downtown Milwaukee and in Madison. However, just today, we got an update from an attorney for Silk that they have cut ties with Mr. Buzdum, that they've bought him out of, sounds like, the club in Middleton and in Milwaukee, and that he no longer has any ownership. They issued a statement saying that they were concerned about the allegations and that while they didn't directly involve Silk, that they wanted to make it clear that they were no longer would be in business with Mr. Buzdum and would try to crack down on trafficking. So it was a pretty disturbing. I would say the affidavits were quite disturbing, and I will spare you some of the details, but they really went beyond trafficking and include allegations of money laundering and torture. Mr. Buzdum is not accused of torturing anybody, but he was accused of allowing and having pimps operating in his business. To be fair, he did speak with me at length a while back, I want to say within the last week, and denied knowing that there was trafficking going on in his club and said he would have never allowed it had he known.
And this was a different Wisconsin club, not the Silk ones that he was just bought out of?
Right. This was a club called TNT, which later changed its name to the Wild Rose, and that was in Dodge County. And that was named in the court documents as well as another Dodge County club called the Hardware Store. It's our understanding that both of those clubs have closed down after they were raided by federal officials, including the FBI.
So what other stories are you watching now when it comes to human trafficking, especially in the Milwaukee area?
Stay tuned. We'll have some follow-ups. There's been some really interesting reports and research coming out lately. I had done an article a few months back about links to group homes and concerns that group homes, when a young woman would go missing, weren't reporting the missing teen soon enough, or that they were housing multiple trafficking victims in one house and making it kind of a fertile recruiting ground. So I think we'll have some follow-ups on that and some other efforts on both cracking down on pimps and johns and trying to provide resources to trafficking victims and or prostitutes.
And here on the program a while back, we talked to a couple of people involved with an effort from Mount Mary University to try to provide different kinds of assistance to people, to girls in particular, and women who are victims of trafficking. Are there a lot of these initiatives in the Milwaukee area, not necessarily coming from a city or county or state government, but private groups like that?
There are, yes. There's quite a number of nonprofit groups, some religious groups. Law enforcement's been working and trying to, you know, change approaches to who gets arrested. The Common Council members, county has been doing a lot with trauma-informed care and trying to combat trafficking at the county level. And then I know that some of the new state officials have spoken with me about efforts that they'll be taking at a statewide level to combat human trafficking. So stay tuned. We'll have some updates on that too.
And then bringing things home to this proposal in the Common Council to boost fines for johns, is there a timeline on when that could be considered and passed?
So that will go, it's my understanding that that'll go before the next, the Common Council at its next meeting later this month. That should be, I think that's going to be on the 16th.
We'll leave it there for now. Mary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Mary Spacuzza. She covers politics and breaking news for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joins to talk about a recent proposal from the Milwaukee Common Council to create harsher penalties for people who solicit sex as part of an effort to crack down on human trafficking. The live-action remake of the 1941 Disney movie Dumbo is at the top of the box office list this week. But long before the movie began filming, members of the production crew traveled to Baraboo to dig into the Circus World archives, making sure they got the look of the film's sets and costumes just right. The archive is the largest collection of circus history in the world. It contains hundreds of thousands of documents relating to the circus, much of it with strong ties to Wisconsin. Peter Schrake is the archivist at the Robert L. Parkinson Library and Research Center at Circus World in Baraboo. He's also author of the book The Silver Man, The Life and Times of Indian Agent John Kinsey. Peter, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be here.
Well, I'm sure this could go on a long time, but can you give us a taste of the range of items and documents you have there in the archives?
Well, it's extensive. Photographs, for example, we have about 350,000 photographs of all media types, digital, glass plate negatives, different types of other negatives, print photographs, going as far back as the 1860s and up to the present day. So it's a very broad range of photographs. As you mentioned, hundreds of thousands of documents, for example, the entire business records of the Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey Circus from 1911 to 1965. We've got several hundred films. We've got advertisements, about 10,000 lithographic posters in our collection. So it's an extensive collection, and that doesn't even touch upon the artifacts that we have. So from a research perspective, it's an extensive collection.
And you mentioned 1860s for some of those photographs. You have older materials, right, going back another close to, 80, 90 years before that, as I understand it.
We do. We have the oldest piece that we have, the oldest documentary piece that we have is a newspaper that contains an advertisement for the first circus performance that was ever held in the United States. It's from 1793 in Philadelphia, and it's an advertisement for the Ricketts Circus, which actually George Washington, I believe, visited. And we have the full newspaper that goes along with that.
Now, we mentioned this new remake of Dumbo, a live-action remake. It's in theaters, and you got a visit from the production crew. What kind of stuff were they looking for at the archives?
They were mainly looking through photographs. They had come by, actually, at first kind of on a whim. I think that they were passing through on a vacation. And they thought, well, we're near Circus World. Let's stop in and see what they got. And at a quick glance, they realized, holy cow, we got to come back. So they scheduled several days at the end of their trip to come in. And they spent about, I think it was about 2 to 3 days here combing through our photographs. And mainly looking at photographs from the turn of the century and to get that kind of, as they say, that look and that feel for what a show would have looked like at that time. And we ended up sending them about 250 photographs. Then our executive director, Scott O'Donnell, took them on a tour of the grounds and took them through our wagon collection and our wardrobe collection as well. So they got the we showed them everything they wanted to see. And in the end, we provided research materials for them. And I haven't seen the movie yet, but from everything I hear, I think it went pretty well.
And the idea was they wanted the clothes to look right and the wagons to look right and just set have that backdrop, the scene, be authentic. Is that right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. They wanted to capture the feel of a turn-of-the-century circus. I think they did.
Talking to Peter Schrake from Circus World in Baraboo. He's an archivist there. We're talking about the extensive collection, biggest in the world, hundreds of thousands of documents plus artifacts relating to the history of the circus. And Peter, I understand there are also oral histories of people who worked at the circus in different eras. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that is actually a project we've been engaged in recent years. The museum has always collected oral histories. So I'm really going back into the late 1950s, early 1960s. My predecessors, Bob Parkinson and his brother, Tom Parkinson. Bob Parkinson ran the library, founded the library. But he and his brother conducted oral history interviews with a number of performers, many of them with memories going back into the 19-teens and 20s. We also have sound recordings of actual interviews conducted for radio from the 1940s. And so we started by digitizing those. But one of the benefits of being at Circus World is we have our summer performance season. And our director, Scott O'Donnell, has worked in the circus community for much of his career. So he's a well-known kind of individual within the circus communities. And so that combined with the fact that the performers that work for us during the summer are not just folks we hire from the area, but people who work within the circus community and have throughout their whole lives, we have performers and their families and their friends coming through every summer. And so we had the idea of, well, let's start to record them, because one thing we don't have really adequately documented is the modern contemporary circus. And so what better way to do that than with the oral histories? And so every summer we do a number of different interviews with individuals as they are available. Three summers ago, 2017, after the Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey Circus closed, there was a reunion of former employees here. And so over the course of 3 weeks, we interviewed something like 56 individuals. Of their recollections of their time with the Ringling Circus and then also the closing of the Ringling Circus. And all of those are available online through our online catalog. So you can listen to these. And in many cases, we have transcripts to go along with them.
Take us back to the mid-1800s, maybe some of those earlier pictures. I think back in this era where, you know, people didn't have TV or the internet or movies or anything like that. The circus coming to town was maybe the event of the year. What, when you look at the pictures and the stories you've collected there, set the scene for us.
Many of the photographs are of showground lots, and so you have views of the big tents, these beautifully carved wagons, crowds along the midway. So there's when you approached a circus showgrounds lot, you had this avenue that was flanked on one side by sideshow banners that would attract you into the sideshow tent, or on the other side you would have concession tents. Then at the very end of that you would have the entrance to the menagerie, and then eventually the big top tent. So we have photos of crowds milling along the midway. We have photographs of the concession stands and of the sideshow banner. So really a full documentation. In many cases, we have photos of the inside of these tents as well, these big top tents. And so you could really get a good sense of what it was like to visit a circus in the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s. Because it was this dynamic, entertaining force, it attracted local photographers as well as the professionals. A favorite set that I have is actually of the Ringling Brothers in their very early years in 1888 when they visited a town called Algona, Iowa. And so we have a set of the showgrounds lot, of the back lots, you know, of the performers, of the crowds. And it's just, so there's like sets of photographs that show the day in the life of a circus. And you're absolutely right in that it did shut down the town. The circus was in many regards at the time considered an educational experience because of the different cultures that comprised of the performers, the different exotic animals. It was seen often as not just as grand entertaining venture, but a venture, but also really a multicultural and educational experience. Quite often, especially at the turn of the century and in the years before and afterwards, there was also the first time people would experience a light bulb, for example, mm-hmm. when the circus had a traveling electrical light plant and lit their grounds with electrical lights. So the first time people saw a light bulb, or maybe the first time they saw an automobile. So it was a place to see sometimes new technology. The early cinematographs, these early films, there was a special dark tent that showed these things. So you could go in the 1890s and see scenes from the Spanish-American War. So it was this amazing thing that came through, like you say, once a year in this traveling city and see sights and sounds that you couldn't possibly see anywhere else throughout the rest of the year.
And one of the pictures I saw online was of not the stars of the show, but of one of my favorite words, roustabouts, the people behind the scenes who put it all together. Yeah. What do we see about the life of the people who, you know, weren't doing the stunts and entertaining the crowds?
Well, and that too is one of my favorite sides of the show. The roustabouts reflect the nuts and bolts side of and the logistics of how you ran a circus, because it was a hard life. It was a great life. Everybody who has experienced it, really, it defines them. It's something that, to this day, they're very proud to have been involved with, whether they're a performer or a roustabout, you know, working guy kind of thing. And these were the people who, you know, pounded in the tent stakes, that set up the canvas, that unloaded the trains and moved the equipment around. And a number of these photos do just that. They show these guys at work and sometimes, you know, at rest. I think we have a couple of photographs that show them literally playing dice games and playing cards, taking a break, you know, that their hard work is done. But it was a grueling schedule. I mean, a large, decent-sized circus was a traveling city, often with, like, say, their own barber shops, their own doctors. And so this was a city that had to be taken apart, loaded up onto a train, moved to the next town and unloaded and set up early in the morning for usually two or three performances, then taken down and moved again. So it was a grueling, exhausting work schedule, but also deeply rewarding work schedule for those who were involved with it.
And very briefly in our last few moments, Peter, is there a holy grail, one artifact or document or picture that you wish you had in the archive that you'd love to find?
Boy, for me, anything that really documents the early 19th century, but also really any document or set of letters that offer a personal side of the performers, you know, and really a set of diaries or a set of letters. Because, again, the circus community is one that it's a very close-knit community. And so to have that side of you know, that kind of the inside view of life amongst the performers, something that really shows that close-knit family-like atmosphere that really makes up a circus family. Letters and diaries that document that. The more I can get of that, the better.
Peter, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That's Peter Schrake, archivist at the Robert L. Parkinson Library and Research Center at Circus World in Baraboo. He was with us to talk about the collection at the archives, biggest in the world collection of circus-related material. Producers on the new Dumbo movie sought them out to get the look of their sets and costumes just right. If you have a story about the circus, a memory of what it used to be like or was like recently, let us know what you remember. Tell us about the sights, sounds, or whatever stuck with you. You can email ideas@wpr.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR with your own circus history memories. The The NCAA men's basketball semifinals are tomorrow in Minnesota, and there's no Wisconsin presence in the Final Four. Or is there? Sure, no Wisconsin teams will be on the floor, but the floor itself, it's all Wisconsin, baby. As reported by the Green Bay Press Gazette, the wood used to make the floor in tomorrow's games was harvested and milled by Menominee Tribal Enterprise in northern Wisconsin. The tribal business has a long-running sustainable forestry program that supplies the hard maple used on the floors of basketball courts. They also have other kinds of trees there, too. That wood is then assembled into a sporting form by a company in Michigan. In addition to supplying 100% of the wood used on the men's Final Four court, Menominee Tribal Enterprise is supplying most of the wood for the women's finals in Florida. All right, so this weekend, if you're watching the men's semifinals, you know, the fans in Texas and Michigan and Alabama and Virginia, they all have their teams to root for. We can all root for the floor. And we have home court advantage. Best of luck with your brackets. I'm picking Wisconsin-grown maple. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.